Hello, everyone, and welcome to an Our Fake History throwback episode. What's a throwback episode? Well, it's an opportunity for me to re-release something from the Our Fake History archive and record a new introduction, just like you're hearing right now, where I get to reflect on what that show's meant to me, things I may have wanted to change, and how I'm feeling about it now, sometimes a few years later. As many of you know, I'm currently on my season break, so the plan is to drop one of these OFH throwback episodes once a week until we return for season 7. That return date is September 7th, 2021. So until then, you can expect a weekly OFH throwback episode. Today, you're going to be hearing episode number 9 from way back in season 1. That was part 1 of a series called Did the Aztecs Think Cortez Was a God? So this week, you're going to hear part 1, and next week, you're going to hear part 2. Now, why have I chosen to revisit this particular series now? Well, at the end of season 6, I explored the work of Jared Diamond, and the conquest of the New World came up quite a bit. In fact, I made a lot of references to Cortez and the conquest of the Mexica or Aztec Empire. Now, later when I was reflecting on those episodes, I thought that perhaps I was tossing around references to Mexican history, and in particular, the conquest, like everybody knew about it. Like we all just know the story of Cortez super well. Now, I know there are some of you out there who most certainly know the story of Cortez super well, but I'm sure there were many of you who were like, I don't really know what he's talking about. So I figured it was a good time to re-release my shows on the Mexica and Cortez. Now, listening back to these shows, there's a number of things about them that I don't love. I put these shows out in season 1 when I was still trying to figure this podcast out. I think there's a lot of great ideas in this show, but there's some things about the execution I don't absolutely adore. There are things about the pacing that I find jarring. If I was doing it now, I would take my time with certain concepts and unpack them a bit more. I also jump right into the story of Cortez in Mexico without giving you much background on who Hernan Cortez was and where he came from. If I was creating this series today, that is absolutely something I would do. Also, when I first made this series, I was still caught up on the idea that my episodes needed to have a limited scope. And I think as I got into episode 9 here and eventually episode 10, I realized that the show could actually be so much more. So I came into this episode thinking that it was mostly going to be about the myth of Quetzalcoatl. But then, as I got deeper into the research, I was like, no, I need to tell the whole story of the conquest of Mexico. And then, all of a sudden, I realized I needed to move very quickly if I was going to tell that whole story over the course of 2 episodes. I think if I was to do this story now, I would go in with the expectation that I was going to be telling the tale of the conquest, and then along the way, I would debunk historical myths concerning Cortez as the returned god. I would also most certainly do this one as a trilogy if I was doing it today. Back then, I didn't know I could do trilogies yet. This was so early in the run of the podcast that I had never done a 3-parter, and I was still worried about 2-parters. So, obviously now I have dispensed with those worries, and this would certainly be a 3-part series if I was taking it on today. Another interesting note about this episode is this was the first show where I mentioned the ancient aliens theory. Now, you'll hear I give a bunch of opinions on ancient aliens. Since then, I don't know if my opinions have changed so much. However, I think I would have presented the entire argument with a bit more nuance. I would have cited some ancient aliens authors like Eric von Daniken a little bit more specifically. I also somewhat blithely claim that all ancient alien stuff tends to be about indigenous people. Ancient aliens secretly built the wonders of the Inca or the Mexica or the people of the Polynesian Islands. Since I said that, many people have pointed out to me that ancient alien thinkers also believe that aliens built Stonehenge in England. So it's not just a bit of anti-indigenous racism. And fair enough. I think that's a very strong point. The ancient aliens theory is not just about indigenous people or African people. Ancient aliens people also believe that aliens built stuff in Europe and in Asia, for that matter. So I think that's an important note of clarification. Back when I was first making these shows, I was a bit more bold, partially because I didn't think anyone was listening to them. I think now I'm a lot more careful. Either way, I think there's a lot of fun stuff in this episode. It's an amazing story, so I really hope you enjoy it. So without further ado, episode number 9, Did the Aztecs Think Cortez Was a God? Part 1. In the early 1500s, the Aztec civilization was one of the most sophisticated societies in the world. The kings ruling from Tenochtitlan controlled an empire that spanned most of what is today's central Mexico. And this was an urban society. The Aztec Empire, or Mexica Empire, was made up of dozens of bustling cities and towns that boasted populations much larger than most major European cities in the same period. They had built architectural marvels and sustained a quality of life in their cities that may have been the best in the world at the time. But the Aztecs also practiced a religion that was built on human sacrifice. The kings of Tenochtitlan would demand that their vassals provide them with a steady stream of sacrificial victims, many of whom were children, to be given to the gods atop their pyramid temples. Their civilization was beautiful and unique, but it also contained elements that can make the modern fan of history cringe. Despite their amazing advancements, this entire society would come crashing down in 1521, thanks to the efforts of one man, the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes. It's often stated that the Aztecs thought Cortes was a god, returned to Earth to fulfill some horrible prophecy. The truth of the matter is far more complex. The Aztec myth of Quetzalcoatl, the bearded god who had sworn to return, certainly colored how the Aztecs dealt with Cortez. But did they truly believe the Spanish treasure hunter was a heavenly being? How did the myths of the Aztecs affect their fight for survival against the Spanish? And how did one clever pirate manage to destroy the most powerful empire in the Americas? All that and more on today's Our Fake History. Episode 9, Did the Aztecs Think Cortez Was a God? Part 1. Hello, and welcome to Our Fake History. My name's Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast where we look at historical myths and try and determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a great story that it simply must be told. This week, we are exploring one of the most pivotal encounters in world history. The incredible and tragic meeting of the Aztecs and the Spanish. This is an amazing story that is filled with both mythological puzzles and some straight-up fake history. So much, in fact, that this is going to be another two-parter. So buckle up. Now, right off the top here, we need to bust a historical myth. The term Aztec itself is kind of inaccurate. It's the word that historians have traditionally used to refer to the people who controlled the powerful empire in central Mexico at the time of Cortez's landing. But these people themselves didn't use that term. They called themselves the Mexica, which is where we get the modern word Mexico. I used the term Aztec in the title of the episode and in the intro just so everyone knew what I was talking about. But for the rest of the show, I'm going to use the word Mexica to refer to the people more commonly known as the Aztecs. I just think it makes more sense to use the names people use for themselves. So as we move forward with our story, remember, every time I say Mexica, I mean Aztec. Got it? Good. The landing of Hernan Cortez in what is today modern Mexico was a beginning of a seismic shift in the global balance of power. By the time he was finished, thousands would be dead from battle or disease, a civilization would collapse, and Europeans would gain their first foothold on the mainland of North America. First contact accounts are some of the most amazing in history, because they're so rare. It's incredible to think that there was once a time when massive civilizations had absolutely no knowledge of one another, and then one day just, bam, you bump into each other and the whole paradigm shifts. I sometimes imagine what it would have been like to be a Mexica person in 1519, completely confident that my civilization was the most powerful on earth. How could I have comprehended the landing of the Spanish? Overnight, you would need to digest the fact that there were other empires far away over the sea, empires equal or perhaps even greater than your own. And their people were aggressive and armed with some very impressive weaponry. Imagine learning that there was a continent that we just didn't know about. That's an experience that modern people won't ever really know again until we start exploring space. Now, this experience has been the subject of countless legends. The most common myth about first contact is that when the Europeans arrived, the bewildered and overawed indigenous people assumed that they were gods. It's a story that traces its roots right back to Christopher Columbus, who first encountered the indigenous people of the Caribbean in 1492. You know 1492? The year he sailed the ocean blue? Right. Anyway, Columbus wrote in his published journals, quote, "Many of the natives visited us, resembling those of the other islands, naked like them and painted white, red, black, and other colors. They brought javelins and clews of cotton to barter, which they exchanged with the sailors for bits of glass, broken cups, and fragments of earthenware. Some of them wore pieces of gold in their noses. They readily gave them away for a hawk's bell and a glass bead. Any small matter they received from us, they held in high estimation, believing us to have come from heaven." End quote. Notice how Columbus just jumps to the conclusion that these people thought the Spanish were from heaven? To me, these people look like they're coming to trade and engage in commerce. He doesn't describe any behavior that seems reverent or worshipful. I mean, imagine if you saw a god. Would your first instinct be, hey, maybe me and this god can hammer out a fair deal for these beads? No way. They saw them as people with stuff to trade, which they were. Columbus's assumption that they thought that they were from heaven was supremely arrogant and doesn't seem to reflect at all the nature of his interactions with native people. Nevertheless, the story stuck and colored all future interactions between the indigenous people of North and South America and Europeans. In a way, this has been one of the most successful pieces of propaganda ever created by European people. To justify the conquest of the Americas, Europeans had a myth that basically implied that the native population just gave it to them without resistance, completely ignorant of the true nature of their conquerors. This is a destructive, racist,
and patently untrue characterization of how first contact actually went down. It robs Aboriginal people of their agency and completely excludes their voice from the story. When I started researching this topic, I came in believing that the Europeans are gods myth was one that just needed to be resisted, and as such, it was going to be easy to debunk. But then I hit a snag. The snag was the myth of Quetzalcoatl. In the specific case of the Mexica, there may be reason to believe that a myth about a god destined to return and destroy their empire may have colored their interactions with the Spanish conquistadors. Where most of the stories of native people thinking Europeans were gods should be dismissed out of hand, this one requires a bit more investigation. It's not unreasonable to wonder if the Mexica king, Montezuma, believed that Cortez was actually the returned god Quetzalcoatl. Some Mexica sources seem to claim that the imminent return of Quetzalcoatl had been foretold by strange omens. Indeed, there were many things about the arrival of Cortez that seemed to oddly align with Mesoamerican mythology. When Cortez himself learned of these similarities, he was quick to promote the belief that he was, in fact, a god returned. The more difficult question is, did the people believe it? Now, before we can answer that question, first we should dive into the myth of Quetzalcoatl. Now, it's important to know that there are literally dozens of different traditions when it comes to this god. He was a very old deity in the Aztec pantheon and appears to have been worshipped by a number of different Mesoamerican peoples: the Mayans, the Toltecs, the Olmecs, and a number of other pre-Mexica people all seem to have had a relationship with Quetzalcoatl. Now, the story I'm about to tell you is actually a combination of two different traditions. Parsing these traditions will be key to understanding how the Mexica understood the coming of Cortez. But before we can pick apart the myth of Quetzalcoatl, we first need to hear the story. So without further ado, the legend of Quetzalcoatl. The great god Quetzalcoatl was one of four brothers, each who ruled over one of the cardinal directions and one of the four elements of nature. Quetzalcoatl was god of the west and ruled the winds of the earth. He was known as the feathered serpent and often took the shape of a large snake with a great plumed head like a quetzal bird. His constant rival was one of his brothers, the god of the north and the element earth, Tezcatlipoca. Where Quetzalcoatl was the god of music, art, technology, and discovery, Tezcatlipoca was the god of sorcery, black magic, and deception, the evil technology. The god Quetzalcoatl wanted to see the world populated, and so he set about creating humanity. To do this, he ventured to the underworld, where he found the bones of ancient people, people who had existed in earlier ages before the gods created the most recent sun. You see, there'd been four previous suns that were constantly getting destroyed and remade in a crazy cycle of destruction and rebirth that's actually very Hindu. Anyway, in the underworld, the gods that rule that shadowy realm stopped Quetzalcoatl and refused to let him leave. But being the sporting underworld gods that they were, they gave him one chance to escape, if he could make a conch shell with no holes make a sound. Well, the crafty Quetzalcoatl took them up on that challenge. First, he got some worms to burrow holes into the shell. Then he proceeded to fill the shell with bees, which kind of sounds like two solutions to the same problem, but that's how myth rolls. Anyway, the underworld gods were impressed, and they let him leave with the bones. Quetzalcoatl took the bones and then gave them life by cutting himself and dropping his blood all over them. The bloody bones jumped up and grew flesh, and this was the birth of humanity. Quetzalcoatl was very proud of his new creations and watched their development very closely. But soon he became upset with how the other gods were treating humanity. Determined to help his children withstand the nastiness of the gods, he decided to come to Earth and take a human form. Quetzalcoatl appeared to the people on Earth and proceeded to teach them a number of sacred secrets. First, he showed them how to cultivate maize, and then how to irrigate their fields to make better use of the rain. He showed the people how the calendar worked and gave them the basics of mathematics and science. Thanks to Quetzalcoatl, all of the ingredients of civilization were gifted to the human race. Now, Quetzalcoatl's jealous brother, Tezcatlipoca, was watching all of this, and he was eager to take his brother down a peg. So he came up with a plan. I like to call it Operation Snow White. Tezcatlipoca disguised himself as an old beggar man and gave Quetzalcoatl a strange drink as a gift. Quetzalcoatl, of course, gulped it down, not knowing that this was in fact the potent alcohol known as pulque. This sent Quetzalcoatl into a crazy drunken state, where apparently he was like every annoying dude you met in first year university. He was singing super loud, playing all sorts of instruments kind of badly, and being super creepy with the ladies. When Quetzalcoatl came to the next morning, he realized that in his drunken days, he had slept with a temple priestess who was supposed to have remained celibate. Hungover and feeling disgusted with himself, he headed east towards the coast. When he got to the water, he built an impressive boat out of snakes. Before he left, he swore that he would one day return in the year known as One Reed to take vengeance on his brother and bring about a new age. He then sailed his crazy snake boat off into the horizon, and some say off into the stars, where he became the evening star, the planet Venus. Quetzalcoatl was never seen on Earth again. Or was he? This story is full of classic mythological tropes. The creator god, the journey to the underworld, the savior of humanity being punished, and the pledge to one day return. It's easy to see parallels between Quetzalcoatl and figures like Prometheus, Hercules, and even Jesus Christ. In fact, most cultures have a story about a god leaving heaven and giving humanity some sacred knowledge before being punished for it. It's basically humanity's oldest story. If you were to ask the ancient aliens people, they would say that the reason we all have these stories is because aliens came down thousands of years ago and basically gave us civilization. The ancient alien crowd particularly fixates on the myth of Quetzalcoatl because this bringer of science eventually returns to his home in the stars. Now, I'd like to take a moment here to address this whole ancient aliens thing. When you're dealing with legendary aspects of history, it's only a matter of time before this theory rears its tiny green head. The Quetzalcoatl myth, I think, gives me a good opportunity to weigh in on this. Now, we here at Our Fake History pride ourselves on being open-minded. As such, I'm willing to consider anything as a possibility. I think it's statistically likely that there are other civilizations out there in the cosmos. I even think it's possible that beings from other civilizations could have visited Earth. I'm not saying it happened, just saying it's possible. But I draw the line at the idea that aliens taught human beings the secrets of civilization. Now, why do I make this my alien line in the sand? Well, not only is the evidence of this stuff flimsy and based on some pretty dubious scholarship, but the ancient aliens theories are disproportionately about Aboriginal people. There are very few stories about aliens coming to Europe and teaching Europeans how to build impressive structures. It's always the people of Peru or Mexico or the Pacific Islands that need aliens to teach them how to do math. Doesn't that seem a little suspicious? It just feels like another way to rob native people of their agency and downplay the achievements of their culture. Now, I have a feeling this isn't the last time I'll need to weigh in on this one. And, like I said, anything is possible. But aside from the more off-the-wall theories about Quetzalcoatl, the central question remains, did the Mexica think the conquistador Hernan Cortes was the returned god of the wind? Well, to answer that question, we first need to look at the story itself. The version of the story I told you is the most commonly repeated version of the Quetzalcoatl myth, but it's actually a combination of two different traditions. You see, there seem to be two different Quetzalcoatls. One who is a feathered cosmic snake, and another who looks like a man, and is sometimes even described as being light-skinned and bearded. This second tradition, the Quetzalcoatl is a dude story, seems to be actually about a completely separate figure, not a god, but an ancient legendary king of the Toltecs. This legendary king was named Seacatl Topiltzin Quetzalcoatl. And I know that's a mouthful, so we're just going to call him Topiltzin moving forward. Now, because he took the name of the god as an honorific or a title, his story is often conflated with the story of the god Quetzalcoatl. All of that stuff about bringing agriculture and the calendar to the people, well, that's actually part of the Topiltzin story. So is the part about building a boat and sailing away. It was Topiltzin who swore that he would one day return in the month of one reed. In fact, all the messianic elements of the Quetzalcoatl myth are actually part of the Topiltzin story. This is kind of like the story of Jesus and King Arthur getting mashed together. So why is this such a big deal? Mythical mashups happen all the time, right? Traditions influence one another and they blend together. This is very true. But with this story, we need to be extra careful. You see, the elements of the myth that connect Quetzalcoatl to Cortes actually come from that second, later tradition. Those making the case that the Mexica thought Cortes was the god point to the fact that he arrived in a boat from the east in the year of one reed, and he had light skin and a beard, just like the mythical Quetzalcoatl. Except all of those details are actually from the Topiltzin story. So we have to ask if this mythical mashup happened before the arrival of Cortes or after the conquest. If the stories had been conflated before Cortes, then the Mexica may very well have thought that he was this Quetzalcoatl-Topiltzin hybrid. But what if this story was put together after the conquest as a way to justify the Spanish invasion? What if this hybrid Quetzalcoatl story was just a way to give the Cortes mission a sense of messianic destiny? What if the myth had been doctored to fit the history? To properly answer those questions, we need to get into what actually happened in the three-year period starting in 1519 that culminated in the fall of the Mexica Empire. Hernan Cortes, the man behind this catastrophic fall, was a Spanish captain, pirate, treasure hunter, and all-around scallywag. A professor of Mexican history recently described Cortes to me as Mexico's Darth Vader, that mean father that they just can't accept. And I thought that was awesome. To his credit, he would prove to be a surprisingly brilliant military commander and a canny enemy. He was formidable, but he was motivated almost exclusively by greed, and he was willing to butcher thousands and destroy irreplaceable wonders to get what he wanted. And he wanted one thing: gold. Okay, he was also interested in spreading Catholicism, but that was certainly a secondary concern. Bernal Diaz, one of Cortes's soldiers in this campaign, summarized the goals of the conquistadors quite succinctly when he said, quote, "We came to serve God and get rich," end quote. And indeed, get rich or die trying seems to have been Cortes's motto for the entire three-year campaign. Cortes's expedition, though dangerous and at times nearly catastrophic, also seemed to be blessed with oddly good luck. Right from his first landing in the Yucatan Peninsula in 1519, Cortes had the good luck of bumping into a marooned Spanish priest named Jeronimo de Aguiar. Aguiar had lived as a slave to a Mayan leader for the past 8 years, and in that time, he had learned the local language. When Cortes arrived, he was eager to rejoin his countrymen and act as Cortes's translator. However, the local Mayan people, known as the Tabascans, were decidedly less excited to see Cortes. They quickly armed themselves for war and attacked the outsiders trespassing in their territory. The Tabascans fought tenaciously, but the Spanish simply had them outclassed when it came to weaponry. Cortes had roughly 600 men with him, armed with crossbows, cannons, early guns known as arquebuses, and armor and swords made from the famously tough Toledo steel. On top of that, Cortes also had horses, beasts that had never been seen before by Mesoamerican people. Cortes's cavalry proved to be particularly effective against all the Mesoamerican armies he would face through the course of the conquest. Some sources even suggest that the indigenous people thought that the mountain warriors were actually centaurs and didn't realize that man and horse were two separate creatures. But that one smells of European myth-making, so handle that with care. What is clear is that the Mexica didn't even have words to describe the Spanish horses. Some of the indigenous accounts refer to the horses as giant angry dogs. Others call them deer that can be ridden. Suffice it to say that this early encounter with the Tabascans was illustrative of how future battles would unfold. The Spanish would manage to be successful against massive numerical odds because of a few pieces of technology. Now, it's important to note here how the Tabascans reacted to Cortes and the Spanish. Remember, we're trying to determine whether or not the indigenous people of Mexico thought Cortes was the returned god Quetzalcoatl. I think we can say with some surety that the Tabascans certainly did not. They treated Cortes as a trespasser and a military threat. They were quick to take up arms against the Spanish and certainly did not pay them any special reverence. When they were eventually defeated, they worked out terms of peace the way they would with any other victorious foe, with an exchange of hostages and a payment of tribute. The sources don't seem to report the Tabascans acting like they were in the presence of a god. Cortes may have proved that the Spanish were formidable enemies, but a prophesied wind god returned? Nah, not so much. Nonetheless, Cortes's victory over the Tabascans led to another important turn of good luck. In the peace negotiations, helpfully translated by Aguiar, the Tabascans agreed to hand over 20 female slaves to the Spanish. Amongst these slaves was a woman known as La Malinche. Malinche was the daughter of an aristocratic Central Mexican family who, through a series of unfortunate events, found herself a slave to the Mayans. Malinche spoke a number of languages, including Mayan and the language spoken by the Mexica and other central Mexican groups, Nahuatl. Cortez recognized her abilities early on and made her part of his translation team. When the Spanish encountered Nahuatl-speaking people, he would have Malinche converse with them, then translate what was said into Mayan so Aguilar could understand, and then Aguilar would relay the message in Spanish to Cortez. This was a cumbersome process, but it proved essential, especially as Cortez began seeking allies against the Mexica and King Montezuma from amongst the other peoples of Mesoamerica. Malinche, who proved to be a kind of linguistic genius, very quickly learned Spanish and soon became Cortez's only translator. Sorry, Aguilar. Every interaction between Cortez and the people of Mesoamerica would go through Malinche, including his historic meetings with Montezuma himself. Cortez, enamored with Malinche, would eventually take her as a lover, and she would bear him a child. She is an absolutely fascinating character and one who is understandably controversial. Without her help, Cortez could not have conquered the New World. To some, that makes her a hero. To others, that makes her a traitor. Apparently in Mexico, there's a slang term for backstabbers or people that turn away from Mexican culture. It's called a Malinchista or a Malinchismo, which is a play on Malinche's name. But she's also seen as a heroine, a brave adventurer who used her talents to influence world events. She's been hailed as the mother of the modern Mexican people for giving birth to one of the first people to have both Spanish and Aboriginal heritage. No matter how you interpret her legacy, she is easily one of the most important women in history that you've probably never heard of. Anyway, Cortez's early victory against the Tabascans whet his appetite for bigger and better conquests. In the peace negotiations, the Spanish had been given a small quantity of gold, along with his new female slaves, and this got him salivating. He asked the Tabascans if they had any more gold, and they said no, but they pointed to the northwest and said, Mexico. So Cortez and company boarded their ships and sailed northwest, putting in the modern Mexican state of Veracruz. He had not been landed for long before he was met by a diplomatic delegation sent from King Montezuma himself. The delegation was made up of Mexica nobles, all dressed in incredible embroidered feather work, and each carrying a rose under their nose to show their nobility. They were led by a local governor named Tendile, who brought with him opulent gifts for Cortez, including chests of amazing featherwork, ornately carved gold figures, jade objects, and most impressive to the Spanish, two massive carved discs, one of silver and one of gold, representing the sun and the moon. The message from Tendile was polite but emphatic. Montezuma knows about you. He will not be meeting with you. Take these gifts and go back to wherever you came from. Now, this exchange of gifts has been interpreted in a number of different ways. Earlier historians saw this as an act of submission on the part of the Mexica. Some sources even related this event with Tendile cowering in front of Cortez and calling him Quetzalcoatl. But these were definitely later fabrications. Tendile was the emissary of a great king and cowered in front of no man. Modern historians now understand the gifts as an ostentatious display of wealth that was meant to impress and overawe the Spanish. This was the tactic the Mexica would use a number of times throughout this story, and it would really backfire on them. The displays of wealth that were supposed to make the Spanish feel outclassed and humbled instead just fed their greed for plunder, which, after all, had been the whole point of their expedition in the first place. Tendile perhaps should have picked up that something was off about these outsiders when Cortez, eager for more gold, said to him, quote, "My men and I have a great sickness of the heart, and it can only be cured with great quantities of gold." Which really reminds me of something. God, what is it?
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, from that point on, it was clear that the Mexica did not appreciate the Spanish in their territory, and they wanted them gone. If you ask me, this doesn't sound like a people rolling out the red carpet for a returned god. But, as we said, after Cortes got a taste of the treasure of Mexico, he became obsessed. At this point, it seems like for Cortes, this treasure hunting mission had just taken on a whole new scope. The ultimate prize was now the Mexica Empire itself. But despite the impressive weaponry possessed by the Spanish, Cortes was in no shape to conquer anything. Not only was Cortes sorely outnumbered in completely unknown territory, but he was also acting outside of his purview as Captain General. Now, let me explain this. Cortes was technically under the authority of the governor of Cuba, a man named Diego Velázquez. Cortes and Velázquez had a bit of a spotty history, and the two were known to openly hate each other. Nonetheless, the governor, forgiving as he was, had signed off on Cortes' expedition to the mainland. But the ability to found settlements, make alliances, and declare war were, according to the King of Spain anyway, exclusively the territory of Governor Velázquez. But guess what? Cortes was about to do all of those things without Velázquez's permission, making Cortes insubordinate at best and full-on treasonous at worst. Cortes would make himself a full-on enemy of Velázquez before this adventure was through. Indeed, his rivalry with the governor would create a weird sideshow that would continue throughout the conquest. His first truly insubordinate acts were to form an alliance and found a town. After his meeting with Tendile, Cortes set off up the coast to find a better base of operations. He eventually found a site near a town called Sempoala, a bustling settlement controlled by a people known as the Totonacs. The Totonacs had already heard tales about the Spanish and their victory over the Tabascans, and as such, they cautiously welcomed them into Sempoala. The Totonacs looked thoroughly exotic to the bewildered Spanish, even by New World standards. We're told that they had pierced ears, noses, and lips, decorated with massive pieces of painted wood, jade, and gold. The chief was an even more amazing sight. The sources tell us that he was a massively fat man, so large, in fact, that he had two servants walk with him everywhere he went, carrying a stick between them to support his massive gut. The Totonacs were a conquered people, who had recently come under the thumb of the powerful Mexica Empire. And, as it turns out, being a vassal of the Mexica was pretty brutal. The taxes collected by the agents of Montezuma usually included human beings who were to be sacrificed in their temples. The Totonacs were regularly expected to surrender their people for the purposes of ritual murder. Recently, the demands of the Mexica had become even more intense, with many Totonacs reporting that their spouses and children had been taken away to be sacrificed. Now, it's important to note that the Totonacs also practiced human sacrifice, so it's not like they were morally opposed to the practice per se, but it was agreed that the Mexica had taken it to a new level and had become oppressive in their demands. In the Totonacs, Cortes found his first allies in his coming war against Montezuma. In the forging of this alliance, there is no hint that the Totonacs made their decision to aid the Spanish because they thought he was Quetzalcoatl. On the contrary, this was a thoughtfully considered political and military arrangement. At one point, the Totonacs even tried to trick the Spanish into going to war against a neighboring tribe who they disingenuously said were the Mexica. This is not how the people of Mesoamerica venerated their gods. To the Totonacs, the Spanish were a powerful military ally, and a potentially gullible one at that. After cementing this alliance, Cortes set about founding his new town, Villarica de la Cruz. Now, this was a potentially treasonous act meant to rid him of the jurisdiction of Velazquez, the governor of Cuba. It was around this time that a number of men still loyal to the governor started to plan a mutiny against Cortes. The captain general had overstepped his bounds and was now outwardly defying Velazquez. On top of that, the men were exhausted and eager to go back to Cuba. But Cortes uncovered the plot before the mutineers had a chance to act and brutally punished the ringleaders. It was this plot that led to one of the most amazing scenes of the conquest and easily one of the most mythologized moments in Cortes's life. The legend goes that after the mutineers had been variously hung, tortured, or maimed by Cortes, the captain general led his entire company down to the beach where the boats had been anchored. He then ordered all the boats to be run aground and then had them all lit on fire in front of the amazed Spanish. The message was clear. There would be no going back to Cuba or Spain. From now on, it was conquer or die. Cortes burning the ships is often cited as the definitive turning point in the conquest of Mexico, and perhaps the history of the world. But, of course, this story is a classic piece of fake history, spun out of just a kernel of truth. It is true that Cortes purposefully destroyed his fleet, but he did it in a much more sneaky and way less dramatic way. First, he had the shipwrights bore holes in the hulls of some of the ships so they listed in the water. Then he was able to say, "Oh no, the ships are old and worm-eaten. We better sink them or run them ashore." Before he did this, of course, he removed all the sails, the rigging, the masts, the oars, all the navigation equipment, and everything else of value, and had it all stored safely away in his new fort at Veracruz. This instance is known as the scuttling of the fleet, and obviously that's far less dramatic. But the effect it had on the mission was exactly the same. Whether the boats were burnt or scuttled, the message remained: there's no boat home. Now, even though the burning of the boats is a legendary exaggeration, I just can't get that image out of my mind. Cortes, in full armor, standing on the beach, a fleet of burning Spanish ships behind him, the captain general staring his men hard in the eye and screaming, "There is no going back. Conquer or die." Well, that's all for part one, guys. Return again in 2 weeks when we will conclude this amazing story. And believe me, there's a lot of good stuff still to come. We haven't even barely talked about human sacrifice, guys. So check your feed in 2 weeks' time when you will get part two of this podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at ourfakehistory. Or you can go directly to the website where you can donate to the show. And I have to give a big thank you to all of the people that have been sending in donations. It touches my very soul. Thank you so much. Anyone else out there that likes what they're hearing and goes, "I want that guy to keep doing that thing," send me a dollar or two. It makes a huge difference. But for those of you that are looking for a completely free way to support the show, then just go to iTunes where you can rate and review the show. We have gotten so many wonderful reviews from you guys. Once again, it's super nice. We really appreciate it. Why does that matter? Well, it helps us in the iTunes charts. And if we're high in the charts, then other people see the show and we can all enjoy these wacky myths together. This week, I also have to give a very special thank you to Professor Pamela Fuentes. I reached out to Professor Fuentes on Twitter, and she has been nothing but gracious and super helpful. She helped clarify some things about this story for me and even helped me with my classically terrible pronunciation. So, Professor Fuentes, how did I do? Did I say Mexica right? I really hope I said Mexica right. Okay, as always, the music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. All the other music you heard on the show today is written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.